It is 8:31, and we have with us in the studios, alive and kicking once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you both? Doing okay?
Yeah, we're fine.
Yeah, I'm doing, you know, as long as George Bush stays in Africa, I'm going to be cheerful as I get up every morning because, I mean, it's much better than the funny pages.
Yeah.
It is. It's been a riot.
Well, we're gonna get back to that, but let's talk about a riot that's in our own state right now, and that is Governor Gary Locke.
Oh, you mean the people pursuing him? Those are the rioters?
No.
Anyway, we've been sitting here kind of tisking over this poll that was printed in the PI this morning that says that Gary Locke would only get about 11% of the vote if he were to run again right now.
Well, no, that's not what it says. It says that 11% of people responding said that they would almost certainly vote for him. He'd get more than 11% in the vote.
Well, yeah, depending on who's running against
really,
him.
Really, really dismal. Yeah, and look at the Republican field of candidates that could run against him. But it's a truly, truly dismal showing.
It is. It doesn't even look like his mom was going to vote for.
What was the percentage that we're almost certainly going to vote for someone else?
Yeah, it's 11. It's 11. Got it. I've got it here in front of me, and here we do the authentic radio crinkling of the newspaper, so you know that talk show hosts do just to prove that they can in fact read and write. 11% would almost certainly vote for Gary Locke. 36% would almost certainly vote for somebody else. The poll does not specify any somebody else.
Are there really that many Republicans in Washington State?
Well, judging from how either John Carlson or Alan Craswell did in the last two gubernatorial races, no, there are not. But it's remarkable. And another 22% say they were inclined to vote against Gary Locke. So here you are, you know, still quite a ways out from a run. You know, he's running, you know, over a year from now.
Yeah, and we're still close to the last legislative session. So I think people are remembering what exactly Gary Locke did in the last legislative session.
But more importantly, importantly than that, you're just at the beginning, because the fiscal year just started, of people discovering in their daily lives the impact of what Gary Locke did in terms of all the budget cuts. So over the next years, as people discover that facilities are closed, that programs are discontinued, that money is simply not available, and that the state is going to hell in a handbasket, you know, Gary Locke's going to get some heat for that. The Republicans are having an incredibly difficult time right now finding anybody to run against him. That may be his saving grace. But the Democrats are not. Phil Talmadge is already running and has been running for some time. Several other people are considering. And that's just astonishing that within Locke's supposed own party, I mean, some people would debate that, but within his nominally registered party of the Democrats, a two-term standing governor and tremendously unpopular with his own party, that 11% that would certainly vote for him in a party that is a majority Democratic means that, doing quick math, you know, 11 out of, say, 55 means that only one out of five Democrats would almost certainly vote for Gary Locke. And that's assuming that the 11% is largely from Democrats, as opposed to, say,
those must
Republicans.
Those must be the 11% of Boeing executives who consider themselves Democrats.
No, they're all registered voters in Illinois right now. But since they're registered voters in Illinois, they can probably safely be registered in other states, probably three or four of them. But no, it's remarkable, and it is encouraging, I think, to the idea that for other Democratic candidates who might be inclined to try and get Gary Locke out of office, that they deserve people's support, that is a realistic run, that people should be looking at that.
Well, we should be looking at runs for a lot of these positions. I mean, at county level, city level, I just haven't seen anything impressive at any of those venues.
Yeah, there's a handful. There are a couple good city council candidates this year, several good school board candidates. So they're out there, and as we get, you know, we get closer to Labor Day, we'll be talking about a lot more of those races. But at the statewide level, it has been truly dismal. And the state legislature is almost always overlooked by, especially by progressive activists. And we definitely need more people in the state legislature, especially the Democratic sinecures in Seattle, where, you know, excepting of Velma Valoria and a couple of other people, it's a pretty pretty dismal delegation from Seattle.
Yeah, and we can't forget that it was the Democrats in the legislature who caved in and allowed the Republicans to pretty much write the budget that we have in the state right now. So we really need to, I think progressives really need to make some kind of overtures to dissident Democrats in Olympia and in their own areas who represent us in Olympia, and try to run people for some of these posts where you've got the same Democratic representative for decades.
Yeah, and for anybody who's ever actually been to, say, a precinct meeting of the Democrats in Seattle, I mean, you know, three or four or five people can take over some of these precincts. There are not a lot of party activists, and that is the level at which, you know, that determines how a lot of these legislative candidates come out of the woodwork. So for anybody who wants to challenge, you know, somebody in their district, it's not that hard to do.
All right, let's move on. You couldn't possibly miss the fact that Mr. Bush is in Africa. It's like every time you turn on the tube, there's he's in with another group of people.
Close the borders.
Dancing children.
Yeah, no, I want to talk a little bit about how George Bush was received in Africa. Here in the U.S. press, you can see the photos of him and a bunch of orphan children in a clinic in Uganda, or you can see him with a bunch of people meeting him at the Ugandan airport or something like that. But he really, excuse me, he really was received with universal scorn. Something that we don't see here in the U.S. press, but is very apparent if you read the African press, for example.
Yeah, the media coverage in the U.S. of this trip has been absolutely dreadful, and both in terms of his reception there and in terms of what he's been saying for you know, domestic consideration here.
Yeah, and he has been met with protests everywhere he's been where protests have been allowed, that is, because they're not allowed in places like Uganda, and Nigeria has been clamping down very severely, not just on protesters and demonstrators since the end of the strike last week, but also has been kicking a lot of street vendors off of the streets in Abuja, and has even gone so far as to bulldoze the temporary homes of people living in shantytowns in the capital of Nigeria, therefore making hundreds and hundreds of people homeless in preparation for George Bush's visit.
We just wanted to get in the spirit of what they do back in the United States.
That's right. Exactly. And it's interesting because even in Uganda, where Bush has had the best sort of publicity and the best sort of welcome of any of the countries he's been in, the opposition parties all wanted to organize a massive demonstration against him, but Uganda doesn't really allow opposition parties to do much in the way of organizing, and so they weren't even able to take to the streets. But the opposition press in Uganda was absolutely savage, just savaged him. And he deserves it.
Yeah, he totally deserves it. And, you know, the absolute scorn, that not in Africa, but in the entire world, for a man who, you know, let's face it, has the most powerful job in the world, you know, 6 billion people on the planet, and this is the guy. And he goes to Africa, and the first thing out of his mouth is, you know, slavery was a bad thing. Well, who handed him that line? Yeah, I mean, it's like he didn't learn that in school, or this is a new revelation. And, you know, it really has just been downhill from there. Just one corker after another. And I've got a couple buttes regarding Iraq when we get to that. But, yeah. I mean, you know, the number of things that he has overlooked in terms of the problems within Africa that he has not addressed, well, he goes from, you know, stage-managed photo op to stage-managed photo op. And the media in this country, especially the TV networks, have been really just incredibly obsequious in considering these photo ops to be news, while overlooking the actual stuff that's going on behind the scenes during his visits and the things that haven't been addressed.
Right. And Africans cannot miss and have not missed the fact that it's only a five-day tour. They call it a whistle-stop tour. And they're pretty offended by that. They see it as him catering to black voters at home and are kind of getting a jump on his reelection campaign. And he has not, in any of his speeches, really addressed any of the concerns of Africans. And I just want to mention a few of those. You might ask, well, what are Africans' concerns that he's not been talking about? Well, first on the list is democracy. Absolutely, at the top of the list is democracy in Africa. George Bush has visited Uganda, which has had no free elections in modern history, and he decided not to visit Kenya, which just had a democratic election. And this is unusual in Africa. The ruling party turned over the government to the opposition in Kenya without any violence or any resistance, which is not only unusual in Africa, it's also the hallmark of a I believe is really a hallmark of the democratic government. And instead of supporting that, he chose to go to Uganda, which not only is not democratic, it also has been sending money and arms to finance militias in the Congo and to extract some of Congo's mineral wealth to use for its own purposes.
Yeah. And had its hand in Rwanda and has a pretty abysmal human rights record of its on its own, too.
Right. And then Bush has not only visited Uganda and snubbed Kenya, he's also visiting Nigeria, where where there was an election recently in Nigeria where the president was reelected, and outside international observers pretty widely agree that it was a rigged election. And in fact, even the International Republican Institute, which was founded by Ronald Reagan, and monitored Nigeria's elections, and they concluded that there was vast evidence of ballot fraud and gross falsification of the election results. So here's George Bush standing there with this guy who has rigged an election and putting his arms around him and saying, "We love you, and this is the way, you know, this is how we support democracy in Nigeria." And Africans have not, I mean, they have gotten that message pretty loud and clear.
And on the heel of a paralyzing general strike, which, while most Americans didn't pay attention to it, was huge news in Africa. And the symbolism of that didn't go unnoticed either.
Right. He gave his obligatory speech condemning slavery when it was happening here in the U.S., but he made no mention of modern slavery. He made no mention of the trafficking of women or the forced recruitment of child soldiers. Particularly that last one, the recruitment of child soldiers, is a particular problem for Africa and something that African human rights workers have been working against for a long time. And in particular, that goes on in the Congo War, and he made no mention at all of the Congo War. Now, he said he would talk to the Ugandan president about sending money to militias in Congo, in the Congo, but he was only in Uganda for 4 hours, where he also had to do a little mini safari, so I doubt he got very far with that.
And now bear in mind, this is the Congo War. You know, we talk about it from time to time. This is a war in which 3.3 million people have been killed. This is the equivalent of, you know, say an American president going to Europe during the early 1940s and not mentioning World War II.
Right.
I mean, it's just unthinkable.
That's right. If the Congo War were occurring in Europe right now, if it were occurring in the largest nation in the region with multiple neighboring nations involved, sending in troops and funding militias inside the country to steal vast quantities of that nation's wealth, it would be considered a world war. It would be. And it's gone on long enough. It started, I believe, in late 97, has been going on long enough, and the U.S. has paid absolutely no attention to it. It really is an issue of racism.
Yeah.
It really comes down to an issue of racism when you cannot look at a war like the Congo War and even talk about it, much less offer to send troops in a UN peacekeeping mission, which is what's going on right now. French troops are there, and there are troops from other countries, but the U.S. would not even lift a finger to help.
Yeah, and it's not entirely fair. Just to say the U.S. has not paid attention to it does not mean the U.S. has not had influence, both because, you know, all sides on the in the war are using a large number of U.S.-made weaponry.
Yes.
Then beyond that, you have the tremendous poverty in the region, and you know, U.S. policies have helped fuel that for many
That's
years.
That's true. That's true.
And obviously Bush hadn't said, at least for public consumption, anything about weapon sales or anything about poverty, really, in his speeches either.
That's right. And in fact, he's probably over there right now trying to broker some more deals to sell weapons to countries like Uganda and Nigeria. Another issue that Africans care a lot about is the International Criminal Court. It really was the genocide in Rwanda in the 1990s that got people started talking about an International Criminal Court, where heads of state that were responsible for genocide and genocidal policies could be brought before a court and tried outside of their countries. And the Bush administration has done their best to sabotage the International Criminal Court.
And there are up to a half dozen countries in Africa right now that could be prosecuted under International Criminal Court. I mean, the Sudan and some of the ones in West Africa. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, obviously the Congo conflict. There's a lot of really troubling bad actors in power right now.
Right, and I want to emphasize too that Bush was going to go and visit a military base in South Africa, and he decided at the last minute not to, because one of his aides said to him, "Look, you know, the U.S. just cut off military aid to South Africa because South Africa didn't sign a waiver to exempt Americans from being tried before the International Criminal Court. So George Bush and his advisor said, oh, no, we can't go visit a military base in South Africa. That won't work. We have to go visit a Ford plant instead.
And this was after the trip to South Africa was moved up very quickly because they were originally going to go to West Africa, but the strike prevented that in Niger and the situation in Liberia prevented that. So he's been dancing all over Africa, which is a very large continent, you know, trying to find the appropriate photo ops without stepping on too many toes.
Right.
And ridiculous.
The final issue that Africans care about that Bush didn't address is cheap drugs for AIDS victims in Africa. It's been a big movement in Africa to try to allow African nations to manufacture their own AIDS drugs. And Western pharmaceutical companies have been trying to prevent them from doing that for a long, long time. And the U.S. has come down on the side of pharmaceutical companies. They have not said that they will support the use of generics or the manufacture of AIDS drugs in third world countries. And that's something that Africans care very much about. So they can see that this $15 billion that President Bush wants to spend on AIDS is just going to go into the pockets of Western drug companies. It's not really going to help them as much as he says it will.
Yeah, and even that $15 billion, we're talking about $3 billion for the first year.
If Congress
appropriates it. And the Bush administration request for the first year is not even the $3 billion. It's like, well, we have to ramp the program up. You know, meanwhile, how many people are dying? And the requests that have been made of international countries for what needs to be contributed in order to make a serious dent in the AIDS pandemic in Africa is much, much more than $3 billion a year. And again, the Bush has not accepted any responsibility for that in his trip either.
That's right. And so in South Africa, you had the ruling party, the African National Congress, the ruling party, which had organized street demonstrations against his visit. That tells you exactly how unpopular he was in Africa.
All right. Moving along, hopping over a couple countries to Iraq. We return to our, you know, we almost need some intro music for this regular segment.
This week
segment.
In Iraq.
Yes, we, because we can't do the little, you know, flashy graphic on the screen type thing. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So now we go
to give it a little name and a little logo. Yeah.
Exactly. Uh-huh. This Week in Iraq with Maria Tomczyk.
Actually, I'll let Jav go first since I kind of dominated the last one. He can talk a little bit about his Iraq stuff first.
Well, the thing that's been really amusing about Iraq this week, aside from the growing guerrilla warfare there, has been two things. Number one, the administration's growing discomfort with the fact that there was a guerrilla warfare there. You had Tommy Franks, the recently retired U.S. military poobah, testifying to senators this week. Being asked why wouldn't he call it a guerrilla war, and he said, "Well, you could use that term, but I wouldn't use it because it's not coordinated nationally, and it's not particularly popular with the majority of the public." And you know, he's sitting there saying these things to Congress, and it just sounds exactly like any number of U.S. generals during the Vietnam era. It's just really, and you know, I don't like making facile comparisons to Vietnam just because it's done so much. But the obliviousness of the U.S. military command and the absolute determination of the Bush administration to downplay how Iraqis feel about the American presence, it's exactly the same sort of invitation to disaster that the Johnson administration did during the 1960s.
I'm going to just jump in and make another comparison to the Vietnam War. You had senior military officials say this week that the U.S. military is overstretched in a way that he hasn't seen since the Vietnam War. We have over half the standing army deployed in Iraq and the Persian Gulf right now, and there's no way they're going to be able to relieve those troops and bring them home. Right now they're trying to find troops from other countries to do that, but the countries that can send the largest number of troops, like India and Pakistan, those countries will not get involved unless there's a UN mandate for them to help in Iraq, and the Bush administration will not go to the UN as a matter of pride. I think it's misplaced pride, but That's the situation.
And this also is showing why the administration's failure to get international support and UN Security Council backing for the war is coming back to bite them at this point. You had Franks also and other people testifying before Congress this week talking about things like, well, we won't be able to reduce our troop levels in Iraq for another year, and it'll be 4 years before we can pull the troops out entirely. Well, it's going to take a lot more troops than that to do the job that they're talking about trying to do in Iraq, and they're going to be there a lot longer than that. And
we already have American troops showing signs of combat stress.
Yeah, the morale amongst American troops in Iraq right now has been described in numerous articles in the last week as having hit rock bottom. Well, it hasn't hit rock bottom. It's going to keep going down. But they're not soldiers in the first place that are designed for police or peacekeeping type duties, and you know they don't have the resources
equipment
to do what they need to
they
do.
They don't have the training.
They're working extremely long hours under extremely high stress amidst a population that doesn't want them there.
And the nations that have troops that are well trained for peacekeeping duties and well experienced are nations like Germany, the Netherlands, and France, then Belgium, the countries that the U.S. will not go to because those are the countries that oppose the war to begin with.
So, and the countries that oppose the war in large part because they foresaw exactly this sort of scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this. At the same time, you have the utter comedy surrounding George Tenet falling on his master's sword around the weapons of mass destruction, and in particular the report which found its way into the president's speeches, not just his State of the Union speech, but there were a number of others as well about the uranium that Saddam Hussein was allegedly importing from the African country of Niger. You know, one of the things that has been missing in some of these accounts, talking about the diplomat that the CIA sent over there, Charles Wilson, I believe was his name?
Joseph
Wilson, I'm sorry. That he made a trip over to Niger to verify the authenticity of the documents that the Bush administration wanted to use. That trip was made in March 2002. It was a full year after that report was discredited that Bush was citing it, and Cheney was citing it in their public pronouncements. So it wasn't just like it didn't have time for that information to filter through. The Bush administration had all sorts of information to know that that document was not just a forgery, a very good forgery.
I think the telling part of it is that Colin Powell had spent some time over at the CIA sifting through the intelligence before he made his UN presentation, and he chucked that bit of information aside, saying that it wasn't supported by enough evidence to include in his report. And then, lo and behold, later, George Bush includes it in his State of the Union address after Dick Cheney had spent about a week over there sifting through the same information Colin Powell had looked at. Now, we've heard all along from senior CIA officials who have talked to the press anonymously that the hardliners in the Bush administration have been torturing the data to get what they want out of it.
And torturing senior intelligence analysts to try
in order
and get
to
them
get the
to,
kind
yeah,
of
exactly.
analysis they want.
Yeah, and
I don't think there's any question where this came from. I do not think it was George Tenet's fault, and I don't think it was the fault of any of the senior analysts at the CIA or even mid-level analysts at the CIA. I think it was Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz and George Bush and Condoleezza Rice who said, this is what we want. You give us anything that looks even remotely incriminating, regardless of whether or not it could be adequately supported.
And in fact, you have Wilson also saying that in a briefing that he was at, that you had Cheney and even Bush, you know, saying things like, you know, we're going to make this work. We're going to make this
mm-hmm.
true. You know,
that's right. You had Donald Rumsfeld saying, occasionally we will lie to you.
Yes.
He said that.
Remember, setting up an office for Pentagon disinformation.
And boy, has he done that.
Yeah, very much so.
Followed through.
You know, the one thing that's particularly telling about this one particular lie is that it's only one of dozens that were mm-hmm. repeatedly made by the Bush administration as they trotted out one after another
right.
flimsy bit of evidence proving weapons of mass destruction. I would love to just see a list of all right. the different proofs of weapons of mass destruction that have been trotted out over the last year and a half. all of them have been discredited, and all of those involved lies or bad intelligence of one sort or another, and they've all been put forward for political reasons, just like this one was.
Right, and I want to also say that Donald Rumsfeld was lying even this week when he had to sit in front of a congressional committee and tell them that, oh yes, we have approached NATO and asked them for their help to give us troops for Iraq. And when he was really pressed on that point, because there were congressmen on that committee who knew that that was a lie, and they really pushed him on that fact, he said, oh, well, really, I meant last December when we approached NATO before the war as to whether or not they would support us. So this is the kind of lying he does. He pretends he doesn't understand, and so he tells little white lies or half-truths. And so I really think you have to look at what Donald Rumsfeld says and say, well, I don't think that's true. Let me go check it out.
And not only that, but he's doing it straight to the face of people who know that it's a bald-faced lie and still feels like he can get away with it, like it's a wink, wink, nudge,
and
nudge.
Like it's
you
fine.
Let me do this for the public.
Mm-hmm. Like it's just fine. So, and meanwhile, inside Iraq, things have not been going so well. Paul Bremer set up a new governing council this week, where he appointed 7 people to sit on that council. Those 7 people would then look at a list of about 15 other people he had drawn up and then decide whether or not they wanted to approve it. And you better bet that they will approve it because the person who holds the veto power is Paul Bremer. Guess who's
our viceroy.
Right, our viceroy in Iraq. Guess who's on that council of 7 people? Ahmed Chalabi. We talked about Chalabi before as being probably the most corrupt exile returning to Iraq, and we've called him the Pentagon's man, and pretty clearly he
is. And Richard
is.
Pearl's man, yeah.
Yeah, pretty clearly he is, and he is positioning himself to be a major player. He's sitting now on the governing council. Paul Bremer also announced a new financial system for Iraq, which will include a new currency and a budget for Iraq, somewhere around $6 to $7 billion for 2003, which he says should be funded largely from oil sales. However, oil sales are going very poorly for Iraq. The oil supply is still in a pretty dismal state. The northern fields are still cut off from export. The pipeline that was bombed a couple of weeks ago was supposed to have been fixed by now, but it was still being repaired when this pipeline was bombed yet again this week on about the day when it was supposed to have reopened, which tells you it's not accidental. These are not just targets that are being chosen at the spur of the moment.
It's
somebody
a guerrilla
is war. Planning to regularly take this infrastructure out.
And I just for context, repeat that again. $6 to $7 billion for a budget for Iraq. The shortfall of the Washington State budget was $2 billion.
Uh-huh.
So they're not planning to spend very much money
on a
country that's in the midst of a guerrilla war, coming off of a decade of economic sanctions and 2 attacks by the most powerful military in world history.
Major repair.
It needs huge amounts of money being poured into the country. And the Bush administration, as with Afghanistan, is not prepared to spend it.
Yeah,
all right. Well, we can continue on that, obviously, forever. But have a couple events coming up this weekend that we need to mention very quickly.
Yeah, Kathy Kelly is going to be who is on at 7:30 of Voices in the Wilderness and has been in Iraq many, many times over the past decade or so, is going to be at United Church of Christ. Is that the church?
University Methodist
Church. I'm sorry.
Temple.
She's speaking
okay, so
at other
the,
places around.
Yeah,
town.
That's the one that's 43rd and 15th,
15th
I believe, in the 7 U
p.m.
District.
7 p.m. Sunday night. Mm-hmm. Jackie Hudson is speaking at UBC tomorrow at...
That's the University Baptist Church.
Yeah, this is 47th and 12th Northeast. This is a woman from Kitsap County who is one of 3 Dominican nuns arrested and recently convicted in Colorado for a plowshares action involving Minutemen 3 silos there. Very courageous, longtime peace activist.
So the potluck starts at noon, and she is scheduled to speak at 1 tomorrow. And
facing many, many years in prison.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then finally, there's a memorial today for Tyree Scott, a local Seattle activist. That's going to be happening at 1:30 at Mercer Middle School Auditorium.
Yes, on Mercer Island.
No, that's not Mercer Island. Mercer Middle School is in South Seattle.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mercer Middle School.
Got that mixed up then. I'm sorry. So that's at 1 o'clock?
1:30 is when that starts. Okay. So, and with that, we are definitely out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors of Eat the State. And very quickly, just give people contact info where they can pick up Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, places where you find free publications around town. You can find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word, .org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, or you want us to talk about your favorite topic, or you don't like the topics we talk about every week, you can call us at our voicemail number, which is 206-903-9461.